Hello and welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Mary Matte. Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us once again. For anybody who's new to the show, the title of the show, Useful Idiots, it's ironic. Okay, we're not actually calling ourselves Useful Idiots. We're not calling you Useful Idiots. Some people call us Useful Idiots because they don't like the fact that we criticize U.S. foreign policy. When you criticize U.S. foreign policy, then you get accused of being a useful idiot for the bad guy state of the day. But just FYI, ironically named podcast, we try to be useful, but we're not useful idiots.
Did someone come at you, Aaron, or something? Or you're just
yes. It's like, you know, on Twitter, you know, sometimes I make the mistake of like reading comments or mentions, and people will be like, ah, look at this. He's a useful idiot, host Useful Idiots podcast.
I know, but it's so dumb. Like, you can't actually make that joke when that joke is one we built in.
Yeah, we're making the joke.
Yeah.
It's our joke. Yeah, exactly.
Joke
exactly.
thief. Yeah, not only do you have shitty politics, but you, you're a thief.
Joke thief. Joke jacking is just joke so jacking, lame.
Yeah.
Don't
so
joke
lame,
jack.
Yeah. Don't yeah. joke jack. Yeah. yeah. Well, let's start with our four food groups. And since you did an intro welcome, if you haven't seen the show before, you're new to the show, four basic food groups are what all news stories can be divided into. And that's Democrats suck, Republicans suck. Isn't that weird? Isn't that terrible? So I have Democrats this week. So let's take a look at what California Congressman Brad Sherman had to say about Israel's terrorist attack on Lebanon. And this attack has been misnamed as a Hezbollah pager attack, which of course makes it sound like perhaps it was something done by Hezbollah. Anyway, so let's take a look at these tweets by Brad Sherman. So he writes, "Let's be clear. In its strategic attack on Hezbollah, Israel used innovative methods to carry out a precise military operation, maximizing the elimination of terrorists while minimizing harm to civilians by targeting military communication devices." So let's just take a look at that. Then we'll go to the next tweet. But what we do know is from the first attack, because they launched two terrorist attacks against the people of Lebanon, but the first one killed 12 people. And of those 12 people, four of them were civilians. So you had two children and two medical workers. So that means that one third of this allegedly targeted precise military operation were civilians. That doesn't sound very targeted to me. Okay. He also writes, "In war, it's impossible to fully prevent harm to civilians, especially when Hezbollah operates in Beirut's densest civilian areas. Some impacted by this operation may be civilians due to Hezbollah's use of civilians as human shields and their use of soldiers when age 18. Okay, here's the thing, though. When you blow up people's pagers and they are at shopping centers and grocery stores, that's not actually human shielding. In other words, that's just attacking people in a place where people live.
Yeah. Hezbollah is also a political party.
Right.
Which means, you know, there are people out just living normal lives. They're not all like militants engaged in militant activity. So he's basically endorsing state terror. And he'd be, it's like the equivalent of basically endorsing attacks on people like him who are members of Congress.
Right.
Who are also engaged in militarism far more than Hezbollah is.
Right.
And who does he think got all these pagers? Does he think every single one is a member of Hezbollah engaged in military activity? You can see from the videos, like they're in like repair shops. There are people in markets. Like when you import a bunch of pagers in the country, inevitably civilians who have nothing to do with anything that Hezbollah does militarily are going to get them. And that's exactly what happened. And that's why you have ordinary people being killed and maimed.
Right. Maimed. Their faces were blown up and they lost hands. They lost all these people were joking on Twitter about the fact that some people, I guess, had like their genitals injured. It's so disgusting. These people are such demons that are making fun of it. Someone tweeted, "That wasn't terrorism. That was gender reassignment surgery." Disgusting. Terrible. And also, let's take the argument that, as you pointed out, obviously not all Hezbollah members are combatants, but let's just say, let's talk about the combatants, right? Because they're claiming that these were their targets. Would these people be okay with IDF members being attacked because they're combatants and they're terrorists?
Of course not. I mean, look at the response to October 7th.
Right.
There were a lot of IDF members attacked on October 7th, and that was such an outrage that all these people have endorsed Israel going on a mass murder rampage for nearly a year.
Yeah.
Because they can't tolerate people who resist military occupation actually fighting back. So Brad Sherman, I say, don't be so sure, man.
Oh, nice. I like it.
Thank you. Trying to take a page out of your book, Katie.
Thank you. Yeah. And I would just say, literally, anyone who's denying that what Israel did is terrorism is either a liar, stupid, or I think those are the two categories, a liar or stupid, a liar or ignorant. I mean, to be fair, you barely know from the way the media is reporting on this that the civilian count was so high.
Yeah, and there was one headline in the New York Times that was like, devices explode across Lebanon or something like that.
Right.
Like, just like, oh, all of a sudden, randomly,
yeah,
all these pagers just blew up randomly.
Right. All right, Aaron, what do we got for Republican suck?
Republican suck. Look, whenever this guy opens up his mouth, it's pretty much an automatic Republican suck. His name is Senator John Kennedy.
It's also pretty much a hilarious moment, Aaron, to be fair.
Yeah, it's true. You're guaranteed a hilarious moment and also a Republican suck. He is a senator from Mississippi. We haven't actually seen him on Useful Idiots for a while. I guess he's been keeping his mouth shut. But this was worth the wait because watch his exchange with Maya Berry, who is executive director of the Arab American Institute. And because she's the executive director of the Arab American Institute, he basically assumes she's a supporter of Hamas and proceeds to add further insults.
You called our decision to cut funding... You called our decision to cut fund. Well, first, what's the United Nations Relief and Works Agency?
It's UNRWA, which is the institution that exists to provide services and aid to the nearly 6 million Palestinian refugees.
And you called our decision to cut funding for them, quote, an incredible moral failure, close quote.
That is absolutely correct. But again, I would suggest that conversation
and
is about foreign policy.
We did that because... 9 UNRWA staff members were fired for actually helping Hamas on October 7th. Isn't that okay?
Correction. They were fired for suspected involvement on October 7th. And of course, even if all the allegations from Israel against these 9 staffers were true, which I don't think they were, but say they were, how does that justify cutting off aid to an agency that is keeping millions of people alive, which is UNRWA? It's like, you would never, and just compare the policy in Israel, which is arming it with tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons to massacre Palestinians. And when Biden made that one symbolic pause on one weapon shipment of 2,000 pound bombs, people like John Kennedy were outraged. So the hypocrisy is just like, it's in a different universe.
It's stunning. And also, I mean, as you said, they are suspected, but, and in fact, a lot of the allegations were elicited from torture.
Mm-hmm.
And other countries, it was such a terrible decision that other countries that decided to defund UNRWA, after the information came out about how those allegations were procured, they reversed their decision. And they were funding it again. But of course, the United States did not. Another thing is, like, let's say that these people had done the crimes that they're accused of doing. That's, I think it's like 0.003% of the people who work for UNRWA that would have done that. And a much higher percentage of the IDF, for example, has committed war crimes. So we should be defunding the IDF.
I would say 100% of the IDF.
Well, yeah, right. True.
because every attack they make against occupied territory, I think technically is a war crime, because what right do you have to attack occupied territory?
Right.
Okay. Anyway, but the clip gets better. Senator John Kennedy.
And I just want to say one thing. I appreciate that he asked what UNRWA is. He's really kind of like owning his ignorance. He's like, I'm going to attack you for defending UNRWA, but just remind me what UNRWA is.
I don't believe that that's correct in terms of...
Let me ask you one more time. You support Hamas, don't you? You support UNRWA and Hamas, don't you?
Sir, I think it's exceptionally disappointing that you're looking at an Arab American witness before you and saying you support Hamas.
You know what's disappointing to me?
I do not support Hamas.
You can't bring yourself
I do
to
not
say
support Hamas
you don't
or
support...
Any-
UNRWA, you don't support Hamas. You don't.
I was very clear in my support for UNRWA.
Hezbollah, and you don't support
Iran.
You should hide your head in a bag.
What even can you say about that? You know, one of the ironies, Aaron, about this is that this was a hearing, congressional hearing on hate crimes.
Ugh. Well, put him on the stand.
Exactly.
I mean, how much hatred must you have in your heart to subject her to that kind of vitriol and that kind of bigotry. I mean, that's a really hateful person. We can laugh at him because he's such a caricature, but he's a deeply hateful, disturbed person.
He really is, yeah.
But he really is the true face of U.S. policy. They do basically want Arab people to put their heads in a bag. They do dehumanize them to that point where they're willing to just tolerate the mass extermination of so many people. I mean, look at Kamala Harris. Like, what's her stock line when she's trying to pretend as if she cares about Palestinian civilians in Gaza? She says, far too many innocent Palestinians have been killed, which suggests that to her, there's an acceptable number of innocent Palestinians that can be killed. But now it's just far too many. She would never say far too many innocent Jews were killed on October 7th.
Right.
If she said that, she'd actually probably have to resign from the campaign. So,
yeah.
I mean, unfortunately, John Kennedy isn't the only person who's internalized bigotry. He just happens to have done it in the most, you know, just
vicious, offensive
way.
Right. I also want to note that this comes after a couple minutes, which we're sparing you, of him asking her again and again if she supports Hamas and her saying she doesn't. And he keeps acting like she hasn't already said that. He's like, you won't even say that you don't support Hamas. She's like, yeah, I just said that I didn't support Hamas. He also asked her if she supports Iran and their, quote, hatred of Jews. It's bizarre to watch it because she keeps saying she doesn't support Hamas. And he's like, once again, I'm going to ask you. It's like, yeah, she literally just said that. Anyway.
Imagine being like a kid and maybe like on that day, like you're on a field trip to the Senate to see how, you know, how the sausage is made, how it all works in Congress. Right. Oh, this is exciting. Maybe I'll get in government one day. And this like insane raving racist gets up and like harasses an Arab American woman. Like that's going to be your impression of what Congress is like. I mean, this is the face of government that people want to show to the world. It's such a disgrace, you know, but hey, again, John Kennedy has provided us with a lot of content, so we have to see the bright side in everything. But man, oh man, it's so cringe. It's just so embarrassing to watch that.
So embarrassing, yeah. It's awful. So isn't that weird? Let's take a look at what Brigadier General Stephen Anderson had to say about Kamala Harris and Putin, of all things, on Nicole Wallace's show on MSNBC.
Kamala Harris would be just the opposite. Why? Because she's an inspiration. Not only is she positive, does she bring hope and optimism, but as a Black woman, the product of a mixed marriage, she will inspire millions of people throughout the world. Our credibility as a nation.
Okay. All right, Steve Anderson, I'm with you there. You know, like sure. A woman of color being elected president will inspire millions. Okay. I'm with you. All right. But do you have anything else to say? Like, let's see, like, where else he takes this.
You know, that we would be able to allow, our country is so great that we're allowed a woman like that to become the commander-in-chief, the president of the United States. That is going to send a...
Okay, that's a little weird. We've allowed a woman of color to be president, like, as if that's some sort of, like, grand gesture. Like, plenty of countries are led by women of color. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And is there a reason why she should not be the president? Like, we've allowed her to be that? I don't know. That's, now he's starting to lose me, but let's see what else he has to say.
Powerful message all over the world. People like Vladimir Putin are going to say, hey, wait a minute. These guys, you know, they truly have a democratic country. They truly are representative. They truly are fighting for all their people. And Kamala Harris is a manifestation of that.
Wow. Wow. So this is... this is Putin's nightmare, Kamala Harris, because she's a woman of color.
Yeah. So like, what's Vladimir Putin going to do? He's plotting with his aides about like what the strategy is going to be for the coming year, you know, vis-a-vis the U.S., Russia's biggest rival, obviously. And all of a sudden, a woman of color is elected president. And Vladimir Putin's going to go, whoa, wait a second, guys, hold up. We got to rethink the whole game plan here because this is crazy. This is mind blowing. Like, you know, this is where like the Russia obsession and also the identity politics emphasis just goes way too far. I mean, I was with him on the first part where he says that like a woman of color being elected president, most powerful nation in the world. Okay, fair enough. But yeah, but that will inspire people. But then it gets into like the fact that we allowed that and then Russia is going to be scared or something. I mean, come on.
So ridiculous.
Very weird. Very, very weird.
Well, what do we have for Isn't That Terrible?
Let's turn to the Republicans, what they're saying about Kamala Harris. And Senator Jody Ernst, in her efforts to criticize Kamala Harris's perceived communist agenda. For some reason, Trump and the Republicans are really going with this notion that Kamala Harris is a communist, Comrade Kamala. It's so funny that they would think that anybody would believe that, but they really are going with it. Jody Ernst came out with a board game to illustrate just what Comrade Kamala is going to do.
How many of you have ever heard of the game Twister? Okay, we're going to bring the floor mat in and you guys can participate. Okay, so Americans have had enough of Kamala Harris's tongue twisters. Their pocketbooks see straight through all of her crooked lies.
That's a weird mixed metaphor. Their pocketbooks see straight through her lies, but okay.
Yeah, that's a lot of things going on there. But what is consistent there is her glee at all these clever puns she's coming up with and play on words. She's just thinks it's the most brilliant thing ever.
Right. She obviously hasn't seen our show because she would realize compared to our puns, she really sucks.
She'd be very humbled. Yes.
Yeah.
So she's claiming to be a friend to small business, but prices are, let's see if it works. Oh, well, gosh. Okay. Spinning out of control. All right. I tried. I really tried. Thanks. Thanks, Shelley. Okay. So blue. Okay. No, right hand on blue. Now our San Francisco liberal is leaning more to the left to force communist price controls. Communism. Get it? Kamala, communism.
We get it.
We get it. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
And she spells it, by the way, for people who are just listening, she spells it, of course, K-A-M.
Communism. Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant. Yeah.
Part of what makes this terrible, besides the terrible puns and weird mixed metaphors, is that it didn't even work. The spinner.
It was a bad spinner.
Yeah.
Whoever made that spinner did not do a very good job. It was probably made in a communist spinner manufacturer factory, exactly. Because there's no way that could be made under the free market. By the way, I mean, not my forte in things like inflation, but what I do know is that, like, what did Republicans accomplish when Trump was in office? So what was his, like, maybe only legislative achievement, or one of his very few? It was cutting taxes in a way that favored the ultra wealthy. And I know some people in the comments will disagree with that. Okay, you're right. I don't have all, like, the facts in front of me to make the case, but I do think, just based on what I've read, that this tax cut wasn't a gift to the ultra wealthy. And that, like, whatever you think of who actually benefit or not, that does increase the deficit when you take away all this government revenue. And they never talk about that. Like, they're always attacking Democrats for spending, but they never talk about how their own initiatives increase the deficit. And meanwhile, spending more on the military, which nobody wants to touch. So it's a frustrating debate. I guess that's what I'm trying to say. I'm frustrated. I'm frustrated. And maybe I should play her spinner game to ease some tension.
But that wouldn't even work because you'd be too frustrated by how it's not functioning. Yeah.
Sure.
All right. And those have been your four basic food groups.
For this week's guest, we are joined by Jim Webb. He is a third-generation Marine, a journalist, a writer, and a political consultant who has worked in the U.S. Senate and on political campaigns. Most recently, the presidential campaign of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., which our guest Jim Webb resigned from over differences with RFK Jr.'s stance on Israel and Palestine. Jim Webb is also an advocacy associate at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, where he focuses on building the Institute's relationships and presence on Capitol Hill. And we're going to speak to Jim now about the latest in the proxy war in Ukraine and that other regional conflict that the U.S. is currently fueling, Israel's mass murder campaign in Gaza and its latest terror attack in Lebanon. So let's go to Jim Webb. Jim Webb, thanks so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me. I'm excited. I followed your all's work for a long time. And it's a pleasure to meet you in person, and even more of a thrill to be on your show.
Well, let's talk about the biggest news when it comes to Ukraine, which was that Joe Biden was expected to approve Zelensky's request for long-range strikes with Western weapons into Russia, but Biden didn't. He pulled back. There were leaks leading up to this meeting between Biden and Keir Starmer last week, saying that a decision was pretty much imminent, but it didn't happen. And it didn't happen after Vladimir Putin said that if Biden approves this, then basically the U.S. will be at war with Russia. So I guess a two-part question. What do you think of Zelensky's requests for these long-range strikes? Would they make a difference? And what do you make of Biden pulling back and at least so far not giving him the permission?
Right. So I think the first part of it is Zelensky's request, right? And quite frankly, and it appears, you know, in the second part of this, I'll answer this, but it appears that powers within the national security state in America agree, you know, and see the writing on the wall that they wouldn't make any real difference in the situation on the ground. The Ukrainians are getting rolled up pretty much in every theater they're in, despite what people might hear on U.S. media. We've been constantly getting a stream of, you know, I would call it copium at this point of good news and essentially just propaganda about how the war is going. Realistically, they've never been able to defeat the Russians. That's the bottom line. And when you take a look at the types of weapons that would be used and fired deep inside of Russia, these are weapons meant to interdict troop movements to the battlefield, to hit logistics areas, to support a U.S. attack in a conventional conflict. They're not massive game changers in a strategic sense. In an operational and tactical sense, they are. If they're used properly and in conjunction with Western tactics, which is something the Ukrainians doctrinally have never had in their military. They've never been a NATO force. They've had elements that have been exceptionally well trained by NATO over the years. But that cadre has, you know, if it wasn't finished off before the Kursk incursion, it's gone now. And it's largely a conscript army, which isn't capable of engaging in combined arms warfare, which is the way that we fight in a conventional sense, not the way we fought for the last 20 years in counterinsurgency. But yeah, you know, not a game changer. And I'm glad, you know, at least for now, despite the British incessant pushing to enable this, that someone inside of DOD and state and possibly one of the intelligence agencies came to the conclusion that, hey, this would not be a good idea. You're not going to, you know, change the scope of the battle. All you're going to do is put Russia and NATO and, you know, subsequently United States in a state of war, which, you know, is actually, you know, what I believe. And I think it's really clear for a long time what Zelensky has wanted. He's known that he can't win this war on his own. And the only way that he can do it is to embroil the U.S. in that conflict, which, you know, quite frankly, even if we were engaged, it'd be quite dubious to think that, you know, we could win the war on behalf of the Ukrainians. You know, there's a long history, Aaron, of folks invading Russia and not, you know, not winning. It goes back to, you know, to put it simply, risk. You know, the game of risk or Axis and Allies. You don't invade Russia, and it's a historical fact that it won't work because of any number of reasons.
Let's turn to Zelensky himself, because he recently explained his strategy for winning the war to Fareed Zakaria of CNN. Everyone's expecting him to present his peace plan to Biden later this month. And he gave a preview to Fareed Zakaria. And what he basically said was, our plan is to make ordinary Russians suffer and they'll turn on Vladimir Putin. This is some of what Zelensky said.
How will the war end? Because you're not going to get a total victory, it seems to me. You're not going to drive him out of all of the Donbass and Crimea. He's not going to be able to occupy Kyiv. So there will have to be some compromise.
It's when you're very strong. When you're very strong. And the other side knows that you're very strong. And you're as strong as possible to make influence on his society, not to be very happy with this war, because he afraid, again, I repeat it again and again, because I'm sure in it, he afraid only one thing. No leaders, no countries, no nothing. He afraid of his society, Russian people. And if Russian people are in danger, if they don't have comfortable life, if they live without energy like our people, they will understand the price of the war, and they will be not happy with it, and they will begin to influence on him, on Putin. That's why I said, make Ukraine strong, and you will see that he will sit and negotiate.
Before you respond to this, Jim, what's amazing about this statement is that this is what Victoria Nuland's been talking about for more than a decade now. Like, you know, way back when this started back in 2014 with the US-backed Maidan coup, after then, people like Victoria Nuland were going and saying that, you know, once the Russian people really understand the price of having Putin as their leader and they suffer under sanctions and they see, you know, all their resources being put into this war, they're going to turn against them. So basically, what Zelensky is saying here is he's repeating this failed strategy of people like Victoria Nuland that's been, you know, their goal for a very long time, which is make the Russian people suffer enough and then they'll turn on Putin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, my first take on that, Aaron, is that it's straight up projection. Zelensky is under a tremendous amount of pressure inside of his own country. And it starts with a lot of the elements that our government has stood up to, include the Azov Brigade, probably leading with the Azov Brigade. You know, there's been rumblings for quite some time that he's about to suffer a coup. And it's really amped up, you know, with the push for negotiations. And, you know, it's kind of ironic. You know, it's ironic, yet it's completely predictable, because every single time we become involved in a country, whether it's Afghanistan in the 80s, you know, pick a spot around the world, Syria, ISIS in Iraq, you know, the people that we embolden, we arm, end up being, you know, completely the dominant faction, because we tend to gravitate towards arming the most organized elements of these societies, which happen to also be the most extreme. And when he's talking about the Russians being without power or the Russians suffering under sanctions, you know, he's really illustrating what's going on in his own country. And if you take a look at the Russian economy and their GDP, they run a budget surplus every year. And granted, like, a lot of their numbers are probably a little bit dubious, but if you talk to Russians and if you...
When Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, he already had 3 missed calls from Chuck Norris.
We all know the man, the myth, and the legend of Chuck Norris. But did you know that in his 80s, he's still alive and kicking butt? Either that, or death is too afraid to tell him the news. Chuck wants to share with you what gives him so much energy to work out, stay active, and keep up with his grandkids. He did this just by making one change. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s.
And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of 5-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/useful.
This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
Take a look at what's going on inside their country. Their enlistments, their volunteer enlistments, are going up with every single one of these actions, whether it's drone strikes on Moscow, the incursion into Kursk, the Ukrainian offensive, or quote unquote offensive, in the south last summer. Every single time one of these things happens, there is a coalescence around Putin and what he's doing, because we in the West have a completely inverted view of this conflict. They view it as completely existential. And rightly so, if you read what they say. Putin has said exactly what he, and I'm not a fan of the guy, let's just, you know, be blunt about that. But if you read what he said, the reasons for the incursion or the special military operation, all the way down the list, they view this as an existential threat to their existence, because one of the key factors is that we were going to put Aegis Ashore systems all the way as far east as Kharkov or Kharkiv, depending on how you want to say it, which would enable nuclear armed missiles to have a flight time to Moscow of about 3 minutes. And, you know, that's before you even get to the fact that it's been a hostile state with growing capabilities on their border for a long time. And it's something we wouldn't tolerate here. So they're not tolerating it there.
And Victoria Nuland recently confirmed this when she was asked, you know, about the U.S. Opposing the peace deal that Ukraine and Russia reached in early 2022. She said, "We were opposed to it once we realized that it would put limits on what kinds of weapon systems Ukraine can host on its territory. And that's why we didn't support it. So she actually confirmed Putin's fears right there.
Oh, 100%. 100%. You know, and there's a couple more pieces to this, right? It's if you take a look at, you know, I would have to say the course of the war, right? Where Zelensky's, he's talking, once again, he's projecting. He's talking about being able to negotiate from a position of strength. And I would say the peace deal that you're talking about would have been their best deal. You know, just demographically, right? How big is the Ukrainian military? How many guys can they put in the field? What did their equipment look like on day one? And they were at a peak. They manufacture virtually nothing. They have incredible demographic problems in their population. And the folks they had in the field were all trained outside the country for the most part. And they were trained by the West. It's, if you read Ukrainian doctrine, they're still stuck in an old Soviet model, which is not the way militaries fight now. It's very, you know, broken up. There's no talking in between different kinds of units. And to give you an example of, you know, how the US or even how the Russians fight now, they're completely integrated. You have artillery units with mechanized units, with infantry units who can talk to air power, and everything comes together like it's like a symphony on the battlefield, right? Someone's has to conduct it. It's very complicated. It takes a very long time to train people to fight like that. And they've never quite had it, and the elements who were capable or have either long been dead or have been expunged, you know, from any kind of effectiveness. So it would have been in his best interest to negotiate early on, and they did, and we broke that up. You know, I think if you even look at Zelensky's body language in that interview, that's a guy who's very, very nervous. He's not confident. He's not talking from a position of strength. You know, we would be wise here to push for a solution, but the problem is, you know, what happens the day after? What happens when your average layman in Ukraine, who has been out there for a decade, if they're lucky, but who has seen tens, if not hundreds of thousands of their fellow countrymen killed for something and largely in engagements that quite frankly were not handled well. Take a look at the Battle of Bakhmut, where the Ukrainians fed in, you know, any number of their best units into an urban fight, which is something you just militarily, you don't want to do. And they were chewed up and spit out at an incredibly high cost for an objective that is strategically or operationally dubious. And you had the caricature in the West of the Wagner guys, right? But, you know, who are they? You know, it's a military intelligence operation. They report to a couple different agencies inside of the Russian government. They are mercenaries. You know, on the high end, they have very good capabilities. But the people they were feeding in there were not that. They were, in fact, a bit of the caricature. They were conscripts. They were contract guys. They, you know, quite frankly, the Russians probably didn't want to pay and had absolutely no bones about getting rid of on the battlefield. But
former prisoners too, right? They were former prisoners. Yeah,
absolutely. You know, these aren't people that the Russians would mind losing on the battlefield going up against, you know, people who the Ukrainians, quite frankly, could not replace, you know, and that's the key part, I think, that really got left out. And it broke a lot of their combat capability. And they paid an incredibly high price for a battle they did not win. So what happens when, you know, if you look at history, right, you look at World War One, what happens when a side pays an incredibly high price and then feels like the rug was pulled out underneath them? And your most extreme elements in Ukraine society, going back to, you know, the Azov guys who are Nazis, have a long history of it. You know, they're not going away. They are a political party inside of that system, and they're going to want a seat at the table. They had one before, and now they paid in blood. And, you know, it's like, you know, it's almost no different than, you know, the precursor to the Taliban in Afghanistan. What happens when the war is over, right? Like they're going to want a seat at the table and to take over. And that's, I think, where a real problem is going to start for us in the West that really hadn't been addressed much.
Something I want to ask you about, relating back to the Fareed Zakaria interview, is Zelensky's claim, which is that he would stick to military bases if permitted to strike into Russia. And I want to know what you thought of that promise, although it's maybe a moot point now, given Biden's decision. But I want to know kind of more broadly what Ukraine's track record has been on distinguishing between civilians and Russian military combatants or targets?
Yeah, honestly, Katie, it's hard to tell how effective they are in terms of, you know, if they're picking out a military target, are they actually hitting it? But I mean, you take into account what they've been saying, in particular with the incursion into Kursk. They want the Russians to feel
right.
What it's like, you know, and that to me looks like a giant advertisement for a violation of the laws of war. Like they're saying they're going to go after civilians, and I would be surprised if they care about who they hit. But at the same time, even if they're sticking to strictly military bases, you know, the Russians have already moved all of their aircraft further back into Russia. They don't need to be right on the border. You let them do it and they only hit military targets, but there's nothing there. So how effective is it at the end of the day? It's not at all. They'll just adjust, which they have been. And then you have the follow on part, which is, you know, these be taken very seriously by Russia and put us at a state of war, and it's not worth it.
You mentioned this earlier, but what do you think of the Kursk incursion by Ukraine? Ukraine going into Russia certainly was very embarrassing for Vladimir Putin. The director of the CIA, Bill Burns, recently said that this was a significant tactical move by Ukraine. But then when he elaborated, he basically only talked about how it changed the narrative. He didn't say anything about changing the reality on the battlefield. I find that odd. It's like, I thought tactical victories in war are generally on the battlefield. But anyway, I'm not the expert. But what do you think of the Kursk incursion by Ukraine? I mean,
yeah.
Beyond embarrassing Putin, did it advance Ukraine's cause, or did it set it back?
It set it back a lot, and you know, I disagree to a large degree that it was an embarrassment. I think it was a trap, personally. I've studied by Russia, correct? There was a piece in I believe it was Le Monde, right when the Ukrainians went across the border, and the Ukrainians were talking about how they noticed that the Russians had removed the minefields right in front of where they went across. And to me, that's a key indicator. I spent a number of years in the Marine Corps. I worked on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. I worked a little bit on the Senate Armed Services Committee. I've studied Russian history for a very long time and have been fascinated by the Eastern Front of World War II. And if you look at where Kursk is, it was an area that was really fought over during World War II. The Russians understand the terrain. And if you get into the demographics of Kursk, you know, it's I lived in the Ozarks of Missouri for a couple of years, and it's very, very, very similar. There are no main roads where the Ukrainians went across the border. That province has roughly 1 million people spread out in a geographic area that's a little bit bigger than Missouri. And there's about 3,000 to 5,000 miles of river that run through the oblast. And you know, you factor all these things together. So what do you get? You get terrain that's hilly. It's either clumpy with trees or wide open. You have no room for maneuver. You have no roads, which make it really hard to resupply. There's a lack of civilian population, which reduces risk for Putin. And, you know, what did you end up getting that went into Kursk? It was really what's left over of their NATO-trained, NATO-equipped forces. And that's a big deal if you look at what the Russians are attempting to do, particularly around Zaporozhye and around the Donbass area, where they have a very dug-in enemy that's in front of them. And operationally, if you're in the offense like the Russians are, and you have a dug-in, tenacious enemy, what you want to do is you want to get them out of the defense and into the open, because quite frankly, they're easier to kill at that point. Your weapon systems have much more effectiveness. And historically, going back to World War I again, the two most dangerous periods of World War I were the opening stages and then the late movements in 1918 when we came in. And both of those were typified by an abandonment of trench warfare. In 1914, they hadn't figured out that they need to dig in and get down yet. And then everybody was trying to maneuver in 1917, 1918 to grab terrain for negotiations, so they were out in the open. And it's kind of similar here, where they have this dug-in defender. They pulled the best units and you know they pulled their reaction forces away from an area they really want to take, and then allowed them, in my opinion, to walk into an area that has really no significance. There's no real factories, there's no military bases, there's no population centers to seize. It's hard to move. And then as the Ukrainians continued to move into this area, the Russians didn't meet them head on. You know, if I was a commander on the ground there and I was really panicked about, you know, a potential invasion or incursion, and throughout history, you kind of look at this, they would be met almost immediately with force. Right at the border, they would be hit. They were allowed to continue to kind of penetrate all the way up these little roads in very predictable areas. And I don't know, have you guys ever watched Monty Python much?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. I love Monty Python. I grew up on it. And there's a skit called The Importance of Not Being Seen, and where they blow up the obvious pieces of terrain all the time. And the point is, like, you're kind of hanging out in the open, right? And this is what it reminds me of, is, you know, the Ukrainians moved in and they emulated US tactics, where they would penetrate to a point behind the initial points of contact, the initial defensive lines. They seized key terrain, whether it be intersections, hills, and they had very limited areas where they could get out and dig in and establish a defensive position. You know, it's these rolling hills and fields, and then all of a sudden you've got a very obvious clump of trees where if you're the Russians, you know where they are. And what the Russians didn't do was target the infantry. They took out the equipment, leaving the infantry behind. And as an infantryman myself, you know, it's very difficult to carry enough equipment and food and water and ammunition to survive without a resupply for, you know, more than a couple of days. You can only carry about 100 pounds or so. And it's been the same since, you know, 1000 AD. So they eliminate their equipment. They eliminated their ability to resupply or maneuver. And then they've slowly squeezed them. And I believe it was about right around September 9th or so, they launched a pretty substantive counterattack themselves on the flanks of these positions, and are in the process of, looks like, of pinching off a bulge with the bulk of, you know, whatever remains of of Ukraine's best guys. And you put all those factors together and couple that with, you know, once again, Russian enlistment rates have gone up through the roof. I believe they're getting an extra 500 to 1,000 guys a week, you know, pouring in on their own without conscription. That's different from their conscripted forces, where it's not that doesn't signal embarrassment. That signals, you know, kind of a coalescence around the threat, if you ask me, or nationalism, for lack of a better term.
Yeah. And this is presumably why, after an initial wave of jubilation about how this has, you know, humiliated Putin, now we're getting headlines like this. This is from Politico. Zelensky was urged not to invade Kursk. He did it anyway. Some of Ukraine's top army commanders questioned the cross-border assault into Russia, according to Ukrainian military officials. And I feel like this has happened so many times. Ukraine does something like the counteroffensive of last summer. There was so much hype around that. You know, Lloyd Austin was predicting a very big chance of success. And then, of course, it was a catastrophe, I think, for Ukraine.
Absolutely.
And then afterwards, everyone says, you know, Ukraine didn't do it properly. We told them not to do it. And Kursk seems like the latest in that trend.
Yeah, a little bit of victim shaming right there, in my opinion. You know, although, you know, I would say the counteroffensive last summer was a little bit different than Kursk. I'd be willing to bet at this point that for once Lloyd Austin is telling the truth, that they did not want Ukraine to do this. They've had incredible manpower issues dating back to before last summer, where they would have been much better off doing exactly what the Russians did during the first Battle of Kursk, and to in effect what the Russians did to counteract last summer's counteroffensive, which is to establish a defense in depth. You know, you dig sequences of trench lines. You man them minimally in each area, and you keep a maneuver force in the rear, which is capable of stopping any kind of breakthrough. And they would have made it impossible for the Russians to prosecute any kind of gains. But this goes back to what we were talking about at the beginning of the show, where, you know, Zelensky is under a tremendous amount of pressure internally to keep Ukraine exactly, you know, the way it is in terms of their pre-war borders by, I would say, presumably or predominantly nationalist forces. The Azov leadership is on the record saying that we will not give up Donbass, and to do so is in effect treason to the Ukrainian state. So it's pretty dicey, Aaron.
You, in a recent interview with the Duran, referred to what's happening in Ukraine as the kind of final color revolution project of the Clinton Secretary of State era. And you said it's the only one that hasn't failed. Can you explain what you meant by that and elaborate on that?
Well, it's the only one that hasn't completely failed. Just to be clear, it's, you know, there is still a U.S. friendly government in the Maidan, or the Maidan government still there in Ukraine. But, you know, I guess going back to about 2012, there was a series of, shall we say, color revolutions that were, you know, where you had dubiously friendly states, whether it's Egypt, Libya, Syria, where all of a sudden there was this, you know, U.S.-backed, social media-driven push for quote-unquote democracy through American NGOs. And there was incredible social pressure bubbling up in these areas. And I mean, I think Libya speaks for itself. That place has returned to a state of open slave markets and freaking unbelievable chaos. Egypt failed horribly. We don't even talk about what happened there anymore. The same folks are back in power. It just didn't work. And then there's Syria, where we literally acted as, you know, Al-Qaeda's air force for a long period of time. And if you take a look at Ukraine, they've managed to kind of hang on for whatever reason. But it's a state that just wasn't doing well, right? Before the Russian invasion, they were in a permanent state of war, low grade war with Russia. It was the most corrupt country in Europe. It was more famous for gun running and money laundering than anything else. Its demographics had collapsed. It had really no industry to speak of, other than what the black market stuff that I mentioned before. And it was still hanging on. And, you know, one thing that I've learned, I grew up around government. My dad was in DOD and he was a U.S. senator. My mom worked on the Hill. I worked in the Senate for a while after I got out of the Marine Corps. And one thing that really drives, you know, elected leaders and not my family, but just what the ones I've been around is ego. Ego and legacy. People cannot, for some reason in our current construct, admit failure or even adjust in the slightest degree when something's not working. And the same people who fomented the Maidan revolution, if you will, in Ukraine are still around. Victoria Nuland, for some frickin' reason, still has sway. And the descendants of, you know, Hillary Clinton's Department of State are still there and still driving the bus. And it's this, you know, it's kind of, to me, it's the last grasp or last dying breaths of a really hardcore neoliberal element that is in control. And if they know that if this fails, then their entire project across the world is going to come over intense scrutiny, beginning with Ukraine, because we don't know. We just don't know how bad it is. How bad the war is, the lengths that the U.S. has taken to ensure the Ukrainians stay on the battlefield. The last casualty count we had from Ukrainians was, I believe, in 2022. And that was BS to begin with. It's up around 10, 20,000 folks. But at the same time, they're on, I believe, what, their seventh or eighth round of conscription. And if you look at the demographics of the country, I believe there was an article that came out earlier this week saying that they have the lowest birth rate and the highest death rate in the world right now. And it's insane. It's insane to think about that. And, you know, I think the fear of these people is that if and when it fails, and it's going to fail. It's going to be, you know, we're going to wake up one day and it's going to be just like Afghanistan collapsing. You know, where people are going to freak out and say, oh my God, how'd that happen? Like, we didn't see that coming. But with people who have been on the ground and people who have followed this, who have a background in the area, warning, saying it's going to happen, it's going to be no surprise. But it's going to be, I think it's going to be a little bit of a reckoning, and they don't want to see that. So they're trying to pull out all the stops to ensure it doesn't happen.
Yeah. I mean, the videos of people being forced to conscript are so disturbing. And it's something that if there were videos of this in Russia, I mean, it would be nonstop plastered in headlines and on, you know, on media and TV shows and cable news. But because it undermines the alleged democratic motives, democracy spreading motives of this war, we don't see it at all. But they're so chilling. They're so disturbing.
It is. I mean, it makes my skin crawl. You know, I volunteered to go to Iraq knowing that the pretense for the war was dubious, but that's because my family has fought in every American conflict going back to the French and Indian. You know, I just have a personal honor thing. I'd have a hard time sitting at my dinner table with my dad, who was wounded twice in Vietnam, and you know, saying I didn't go, and he never pushed me. But, you know, to be hunted, you know, to be hunted down and beaten into submission and drug off and given 2 weeks of training and thrown into a trench line. I mean, that's murder. There's nothing short of it. You know, and I can't imagine that, you know, and I mean, we've had our own draft riots in the US, Civil War. We had a draft riot. We had all kinds of draft riots during Vietnam. But, you know, it became, you know, to contrast this, like it became kind of chic to burn your draft card in front of a TV camera in the 60s or 70s. Man, you try that in Ukraine, like you're going to get your skull cracked and then you're probably going to, you know, be a bullet sponge less than a month later. It's just disgusting.
Right.
We're going to move on to the other regional disaster that Joe Biden is fueling. But one more question for me about Ukraine. I want to ask you about the opening of Russia's invasion. So the line from the White House is that Putin, Russia tried to take over all of Ukraine, but because of Ukraine's resistance, they failed. Putin says, he said this recently, he said, I never wanted to take over Kyiv. I was just trying to basically force Ukraine into the negotiations that they refused to engage in before in terms of implementing the Minsk Accords and making peace in the Donbas, which is where millions of ethnic Russians live. And there had been that war there ever since the 2014 coup. But then again, it does seem to me that Putin was fed this idea that there would not be a strong Ukrainian resistance and maybe Ukraine put up more of a fight than he anticipated. So who do you think is right here? Or like, what do you think actually happened? Do you think Russia was trying to take over all of Ukraine and they failed? Or what do you think actually happened in those early days of this war? Or at least of this phase of the war, because it began back in 2014.
And to hear the rest of the interview, please go to usefulidiotspodcast.com.
Well, that was great and a really interesting perspective that we don't always get on this show. And I highly recommend people, if they're not already subscribers to usefulidiotspodcast.com, highly recommend it, because one of the things that we talk to Jim about is his time working with RFK.
Yes, he was an advisor to the RFK Jr. presidential campaign, but resigned when RFK Jr. came out as like a fanatical supporter to the right of Joe Biden on Israel-Palestine.
Right.
What's up with that?
And
we try to get some answers from someone who advised the man himself.
He also has some really fascinating things to say about the Israeli terrorist strike against Lebanon.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he makes the point at the end that, you know, there's so much potential for the left to work with people who are conservative in opposing war, because in U.S. politics today, that does seem to be kind of the only last people left who actually are against war, which is people on the left, or what's left of the left, and some people on the right. So, you know, we can put aside our differences. As Kamala Harris said, like, I don't know, 25 times in her debate with Trump, there's more that unites us than divides us. So taking a page from her book, we can maybe unite on things like opposing wars and mass murder campaigns by our client states.
So we will see you all next week. Thanks so much. Bye.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening to and watching Useful Idiots. For extended episodes, bonus content, and our weekly Thursday Throwdown episode, please subscribe at usefulidiotspodcast.com. Support the show for free by subscribing on YouTube, Rumble, and wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the podcast, don't forget to rate and review. You can also follow us on Twitter at usefulidiotpod. Thanks for supporting independent media. We'll see you next time.
This is an ad by BetterHelp. What are your self-care non-negotiables? It's hard to make time for the things that keep you healthy, but being consistent with self-care is like working a muscle. And when life gets crazy, that muscle keeps you strong. Therapy is the ultimate self-care, and BetterHelp makes it easy to get started with affordable online sessions you can do from anywhere. Never skip therapy day with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com today to get 10% off your first month.